The following is for your ears only.
I'm David Alpern.
I'm Mark Garber, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Reheating the Cold War, violent division in Ukraine, and hints of Russian intervention, just as the Pentagon proposes more downsizing.
Keystone Pipe lies. A new investigation disputes many arguments for the controversial pipeline from Canada.
Not stem cells, but selling STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. For Women's History Month, we link female pioneers with programs for girls today.
Musicals tonight. A small nonprofit theater unearths, reconstructs, and often stages New York debuts for little-known gems of the past.
Banjo Bell, B-E-L-L-E, Cynthia Sayre wins praise for jazz improvisation in performance worldwide. Quite away from country.
Plus, notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For your ears only for the week of March 2nd, I'm David Alpern.
And I'm Mark Garber with this quote from the news. I got high without always thinking about the harm that it could do. I didn't always take school as seriously as I should have. I made excuses. Sometimes I sold myself short. That was President Obama admitting his own sometimes wayward youth in launching a $200 million five-year initiative called My Brother's Keeper in order to help black youth today with help from business leaders, religious groups, entertainment, and sports stars. Also last week, First Lady Michelle Obama spotlighted improved food labeling to help consumers fight obesity, a growing problem except in the very youngest children, according to a new CDC report. Now this.
We are staying here. We are all the same common people as you are. We have absolutely the same rights of you. We just consider that we are Russian compatriots, and here we have the Russian flag.
We expect other nations to respect Ukraine's sovereignty and avoid provocative actions. That's why I'm closely watching Russia's military exercises along the Ukrainian border.
Focus on fury in Ukraine shifted last week from the protests in Kiev that drove out President Viktor Yanukovych to Crimea just across the Russian border. Pro-Russian forces there seized government offices against a background of increasing military and paramilitary action that Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel declared worrisome and some Ukrainian national leaders called an invasion.
Developments in Ukraine added to the overseas challenges confronting President Obama and provided more fuel for criticism of his policies on Russia, Syria, Iran, Afghanistan, and the Middle East. Even as Secretary Hagel delivered plans for a record downsizing of U.S. military might in the era of deadly anti-terrorist drone attacks and developing cyber warfare. To consider these and related developments for your ears only, we're joined again by Dr. Paul Piller, a 28-year CIA veteran, now a non-resident senior fellow at Georgetown University Center for Security Studies and the Brookings Institution. He blogs at www.nationalinterest.org. Welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you.
The Russians have admitted using security forces to protect their major naval base long established in the Crimea. Do you see an actual invasion in all the troops in uniform without insignia or covert assistance by Moscow to pro-Russian militias already in the area or something else?
The Russians have some rights under the agreement they reached with Ukraine when the Soviet Union fell apart for presence and movement of troops in Crimea. So I don't think you can call it an invasion, at least not yet. But certainly when you have Russian armed personnel in Ukrainian territory, you could say it amounts to pretty much the same thing. We ought to listen also to what President Putin was saying in asking the upper house of his own rubber stamp parliament to give him permission for actual intervention of military forces.
Even those who propose more massive Western economic aid to hold Ukraine together admit it's a long shot because the eastern region has far closer ethnic and economic ties to Russia. What's your view and how far should we go to affect the situation there?
Well, whether Ukraine stays in one piece or not is not going to be up to the United States. Whether it stays in one piece is a good thing is subject to argument. I think overall it probably would be a bad thing to see it fall apart, mainly because of the questions it would raise about where that kind of unraveling would stop. What would it mean, for example, for Kazakhstan, which has about a 30% ethnic Russian population? So overall, I think everyone's hoping it's going to stay together.
Well, what about the warning that too much U.S. and Western involvement could taint the more moderate democratic factions we might favor?
We're never doing a favor to moderate democratic factions by having them appear to be a tool of the West. And in this case, there's not only the problem of tainting, but also if we got more directly involved, it would certainly complicate the prospects for reaching any kind of understanding with Putin about U.S. and Russian cooperation in trying to tamp the situation down.
You've also warned about fixating on democracy expressed in the streets or at the polls to the exclusion of other attributes we would want a country to have or develop.
Well, I think it's important to be clear, you know, what's democracy and what isn't. And in Ukraine, regardless of how we might think of Viktor Yanukovych, and you can call him a thug and a corrupt kleptomaniac, but he did win a fair and free election in 2010. And so the removal from him of office is not exactly a democratic act, even if on other grounds we might say it was a good thing.
Dr. Piller, does the Ukraine situation seem to undermine Hagel's plan for a downsized U.S. military or demonstrate how little use massive force would be in the situation unless we want a hot war with Russia?
It demonstrates how little use massive force would be in this situation. I don't think anyone's talking about any good that U.S. troops introduced into what would become a U.S.-Russian land war, what good that would do. That would be a disaster.
What about the newer phases of confrontation? We read last week that Obama was rejecting a plan for debilitating cyber attacks on Syria to limit Assad regime assaults on opposition forces and civilian centers. One fear is that Assad supporters like Iran, Russia, or China might secretly do the same to us. What's your view on that?
There's an issue that goes well beyond the Syrian situation and involves how people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. If cyber warfare generally were to escalate beyond the modest levels it's been at so far, the United States would probably have more to lose than anyone else. And so I think that prospect is something that ought to be kept uppermost in mind when anyone talks about use of cyber attacks.
Well, speaking of prospects, what do you see as prospects for the Syrian peace talks, for more humanitarian aid, and for the removal of chemical weapons that last week made only a little more progress?
I think there's the most ground for optimism with regard to the chemical weapons agreement. Sure, it's dragged a little bit, but it's unclear whether that's how much of that is deliberate foot dragging by the Syrian regime and how much is just a reflection of the very chaotic situation. Assad knows that one of the things that is his claim to staying in power, at least in the short to medium term, is he's one of the parties to this agreement. So I'd be more optimistic on that. I'm much more pessimistic with regard to the overall Syrian situation and peace talks. We may be facing something as similar as what we saw in Lebanon when it had a civil war that ground on for about a decade and a half before all sides were exhausted.
What about the just-concluded talks with Iran over steps to limit its nuclear development? Real progress or a diversion while their program continues?
Real progress. The whole process is on track, as indicated by the subsequent agreements to the Joint Plan of Action that was reached in November, as indicated also by the report we got recently from the International Atomic Energy Agency, which certified that the Iranians are doing exactly what they committed to do with regard to doing away with their 20% enriched uranium stockpile.
There's also continuing debate, amazingly public, about the possibility of a death by drone attack on an American-born jihadi in Pakistan. Talk about that and the need you see for more regulation and congressional legislation.
Well, I think we as a country have not yet resolved some very serious differences regarding how you handle U.S. citizens who are accused of wrongdoing overseas. When you have something like a drone attack on a U.S. citizen, you've got, at a minimum, constitutional issues about whether the Fifth Amendment requirements for due process of law before you deprive someone of life and liberty have been completed. And I think this is an area where heavy congressional involvement to set rules and to determine priorities and relative emphasis between security and individual liberties is entirely appropriate. It's not something that should just be left to the executive branch.
Dr. Paul Piller is a 28-year CIA veteran, now a non-resident senior fellow at Georgetown University Center for Security Studies and the Brookings Institution. He blogs at www.nationalinterest.org.
Quote from the news, "No internet safety means no national security. No informatization means no modernization." That was China's President Xi Jinping announcing a new effort to increase cybersecurity measures, though his nation is generally considered a major center of international cyber hacking for security and commercial purposes.
Next, claims and counterclaims on the Keystone XL pipeline. For your ears only. back with For Your Ears Only. I'm Mark Garber.
And I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. We cannot cause traffic problems in front of his house, can we? Flights to Tel Aviv all mysteriously delayed. That was an email exchange between two appointees of New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, joking about a local rabbi who did not endorse Christie's reelection just days after their previous email exchange that triggered controversial lane closings on the George Washington Bridge. Now this.
No to the Keystone XL pipeline.
No KXL.
The net effects of the pipeline's impact on our climate will be absolutely critical to determining whether this project is allowed to go forward.
As opponents of the proposed $5 to $7 billion Keystone XL pipeline plan to sit in and arrests at the White House this weekend, the Center for Media and Democracy released a new documentary and series of investigative reports refuting key claims for the 1,200-mile pipeline to bring sludgy tar sands oil from Canada to refineries and shipping facilities in Port Arthur, Texas. And with the official period for public comment scheduled to end this week, to outline key findings of the CMD investigation, For Your Ears Only, we have the man behind the movie Keystone Pipe Lies exposed. He's Dave Saldana, an Emmy Award-winning TV writer, director, and civil rights attorney. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let's go through some of the key claims and counterclaims about Keystone XL. First, that it would create more than 100,000 jobs at a time when the U.S. economy dearly needs them. What projection did you find more accurate and why?
Yeah, well, that one, that 100,000 plus projection came from a study that was funded by TransCanada, the company that's trying to build this pipeline. And the Cornell Global Labor Institute went through that that study and found it to be, in quotation marks, unsubstantiated, which means they made it up. They didn't have any facts to back it up, so they just made it up. The study that we find more reliable is the one from the U.S. State Department, which says that 3,900 jobs will be created during construction, and maybe once construction is done, 50 permanent jobs or 35 permanent full-time jobs and 15 contractor jobs will be used to maintain the pipeline. Doesn't sound like much of a jobs plan to me, and it certainly doesn't sound like it to our friend Anthony Swift at the Natural Resources Defense Council, who testified before Congress that you're statistically more likely to get struck by lightning than you are to get a job on Keystone XL.
If not jobs for workers, what about claims that the project would produce billions of dollars in revenue for the government from corporate taxes? You found a major tax loophole.
That came from Oil Change International and a report by Doug Coplow of EarthTrack last July that found that the use of a legal fiction called master limited partnerships has skyrocketed in the oil and energy industry. And it's just a definition that like a limited liability corporation or something that they can use to basically avoid taxes for everybody involved. So minimal at best taxes for shareholders and almost no taxes for the corporations themselves. That's in addition to the fact that the pipeline will be offloading at refineries in Port Arthur, Texas, and part of that Golden Triangle near Houston, which are all free trade zones, which means there's no export tax either.
Well, similarly, you report that corporations involved might be exempt from paying into a disaster insurance fund to help cover costs of any accident. Explain that.
That is one of the most shocking and horrifying things that we uncovered in our research. Pipelines are incredibly risky, as folks know. And there's an oil spill liability trust fund, which is like a giant insurance fund. And oil producers and pipeline companies that transport them have to put in about 8 cents per barrel, rather, that flows through the pipelines. And that's to guard against a situation similar to what we saw in West Virginia, where the coal chemicals got dumped into the water supply, and the company declared bankruptcy, saying, we can't clean this up. So to protect against that and protect taxpayers from having to foot the bill for cleanups, this trust fund exists to fund any cleanup necessary that a company can't cover, except an IRS determination on the meaning of the law that created that trust fund unconventional oils, and tar sands oil is considered an unconventional oil, are exempt. So basically we have a substance that is more toxic, more caustic, more expensive, and harder to clean up that is completely exempt from this trust fund that would cover the cost of cleanup.
Let's talk more about accidents, since one argument for the pipeline is that it would avoid the kind of fiery explosions and leaks we've seen from some recent disasters involving railroad tanker cars. Give us some examples of accidents that you found in parts of Keystone and similar pipelines already in operation.
Well, the Mayflower, Arkansas pipeline leak is one that folks will probably be familiar with. Happened last year. And it was a little semi-rural, suburban-type area that had literally had oil running down the streets like a river. That town has been decimated. Houses are boarded up. People have been evacuated. If you do a simple real estate search in that area, you'll see that dozens and dozens of houses are selling at rock-bottom prices because people can't get away from there fast enough. A bigger one that surprisingly few people know about is in the Kalamazoo River that more than 2 years ago, there was a different company called Enbridge running a pipeline along the Kalamazoo River in Michigan that leaked somewhere between 800,000 and 1 million gallons of oil into the Kalamazoo River. That cleanup is still not complete. You know, more than 2 years later, the cost is over $1 billion. You know, the fact is we simply don't know how to clean up a diluted bitumen. That's what tar sands oil is technically called, spill, because it's mixed with solvents that make the oil sink where typical oil would float, and you can just sort of skim it off the top to the extent that you can. So here we've got the entire water column from surface to bed completely contaminated with oil, and they just don't know how to clean it up. You know, we're over $1 billion in that one. That puts it at a per-barrel price higher than the Deepwater Horizon spill.
And, Dave, there are already reports some unused sections of KXL pipeline are showing perforation, right?
Yes. In fact, there's a someone I would really like to sit down with, a fellow named Evan Vokes, who was a TransCanada engineer who was fired by the company for being a whistleblower because he repeatedly made complaints that they were using inadequate equipment, that their welds were faulty, that their materials were defective. And those for, I believe, 5 years, he complained about that and eventually was just terminated. So we know that TransCanada is cutting corners everywhere they can. So it's only a matter of time before a similar disaster, you know, God forbid this pipeline gets approved, you know, it's only a matter of time before similar disasters to Kalamazoo and Mayflower or even worse happen on U.S. soil.
Dave Saldana is an Emmy Award-winning TV writer, director, and civil rights attorney, and the man behind the film Keystone Pipe Lies Exposed, co-produced with the Center for Media and Democracy. Their website is prwatch.org/CMD.
Now, this quote from the news, the Tea Party will be coming back with a vengeance, but we're still in the rebuilding phase. That was filmmaker Judd Saul at the conservative movement's fifth anniversary, fraught with frustration over recent setbacks in Congress and record-high disapproval ratings in various national polls.
Next, Women in Science, yesterday, today, and tomorrow, for your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Mark Garber. Quote from the news, I call them like I see them, despite the cheers or the boos from the crowd. That was Arizona Governor Jan Brewer on vetoing a controversial bill allowing business owners to refuse service to gays or others who offended their religious beliefs. It had generated a groundswell of opposition from civil liberties groups and major corporations fearing loss of business. Also last week, a federal judge in Texas struck down that state's ban on gay marriage as violating the U.S. Constitution. And U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder indicated his support for any state attorney general refusing to defend bans on same-sex marriage that they believe are discriminatory. Now this.
What do I do? What do I do?
Okay, that doesn't sound good.
7 minutes to get out of here. Clear skies with a chance of satellite debris. Let's go visit the Chinese station.
With or without an Academy Award, actress Sandra Bullock in Gravity may do at least as much as any real female astronaut, researcher, or inventor to make young women think of careers in science, technology, engineering, and math, known collectively as STEM.
As Women's History Month gets underway, for your ears only, we want to talk about some of the real women pioneers of science, and also what more can be done to get more American girls following their footsteps. On the line for that conversation is electrical engineer Karen Purcell, founder-president of PK Electrical, author of Unlocking Your Brilliance, Smart Strategies for Women to Thrive in Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math, from the Greenleaf Book Group Press. Welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with your personal story. I gather you were not encouraged very much in school about a STEM career. How did you come to it in the end?
I was really so very fortunate that I actually had a high school physics teacher that pointed out to me one day. He said, when you go to college, you should consider engineering. And I said, engineering? What is that? And he said, well, engineers can do anything. So that's really how I got into it. I decided to try it because it was heavily math-based, and here I am today, an electrical engineer.
And you were good at math, I guess. What are some of the things you and your firm specialize in now?
We create the blueprints or the plans for electrical systems for buildings. So we work primarily with architects and building owners, and we work a lot on lighting systems, power systems. Really, anything that has a wire within a building, we do the design for that.
Talk about female pioneers in science.
Well, I think one of my biggest people that inspire me is Sally Ride, who was the first American female astronaut in space. And I just think that what she has done really served as a springboard for other young women that would like to get into any of the sciences.
Less well known is the role of women in the Manhattan Project and other areas of nuclear development.
Well, yes, I think that, you know, for a long time, women were kind of just behind the scenes and really weren't really pushed in that direction. And so I think that, you know, even though they played an important role, they were not highlighted in any of those projects.
How inspiring do you see more contemporary women in science and tech? Marissa Mayer, Sheryl Sandberg, Meg Whitman, sort of on the internet frontier.
They are absolutely a true inspiration because as young girls can see these high-profile women out there in positions that maybe one day they would like to become, it becomes more of a reality to them and something that they can reach for and they see it as a real thing. And so absolutely, I think that these women are just doing great things to really encourage and inspire young girls to go into any of the STEM fields.
Well, what are the factors involved with far fewer girls than we'd like going in for advanced math and science careers?
One of the things is just getting these girls exposed. Unfortunately, there's a lack of exposure to young girls. And then, you know, once we get to middle school and high school, girls just aren't really directed there. And so I think that exposing girls to activities really can make a difference.
What role do you see for businesses, especially tech firms? I mean, people, the companies that are already doing this stuff, should they be doing more to make themselves attractive to women and to help women along?
Yes. People that are working for these large firms or any firm in the STEM area, they can serve as mentors. They can participate in different activities with these young girls. They can speak at schools. They can have girls come to their facilities and show them really what it's all about. And so absolutely, I think that, and it doesn't matter if it's a man or a woman, that it's very important to have those in the STEM fields really showcase and show girls what it's like to be in the STEM fields.
And the federal and state governments, what role will they play?
I think providing the funding for STEM-related programs really would help. Like, help fund, you know, after-school programs that are focused on science and math and make all those programs fun. What a better way to get girls involved and boys involved as well, but to have the funding available so that the teachers, the educators, the parents, everyone can really support these types of programs.
Well, you mentioned boys as well. Are men in science reluctant to bring in more women?
As time continues on, it's becoming a more commonplace. However, there are certain circumstances where men are reluctant or they just are not used to that. It's not their culture. And so there does become this kind of hesitation, so to speak, to bring women in.
What advice do you have for young girls who say they think they might be interested in science or math?
I would say do your research, get out there and explore different options. You know, the internet is such a great tool to see really what's out there and really get out there and talk to people. Talk to people in the community, call different companies. A lot of them are more than happy to have you come over and learn more about what it's like to have a career in the sciences, the technology, engineering, or math, and then really learn about what options are, because these girls don't realize what's available out there for them. And, you know, maybe they have a strong background in math and they really want to do something in math. And I think they really need to take charge and educate and ask parents for support, ask guidance counselors, educators, and so forth to really help them discover what's out there.
Going back to the gravity clip we used to start the discussion, do you think there's a bigger role for media, both more journalistic spotlighting of real women in STEM and more fictional features with successful women as scientist stars?
Yes, I do. I think that, you know, everyone is tuned into the media and what's going on. And so I think that the more that women can be highlighted in STEM, the more these young girls are going to see that, hey, this is a reality and this is something that I can do. Why can't I be that astronaut, or why can't I be that engineer, or whatever the case may be? So absolutely, I think the more that it's out there and the more that STEM becomes a common word, the more everyone will realize what's available to them.
Electrical engineer Karen Purcell is founder, president of PK Electrical, the author of Unlocking Your Brilliance, Smart Strategies for Women to Thrive in Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math, from the Greenleaf Book Group Press.
Quote from the news, instead of fearing sexist attacks, we wait gleefully for the next one. That was Democratic political strategist Jen Bluestein on the party's successful fundraising efforts, key to controversial remarks by Republican leaders, such as calling Texas gubernatorial candidate Wendy Davis abortion Barbie and pregnant women fetal hosts.
Next, digging up old musicals and stitching them back to life. For your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Mark Garber.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Wow, take that, SeaWorld. They've got to be getting nervous now. That was an email from Laura Padgett, a Labor Department safety compliance officer, that raised questions about her independent investigation of a killer whale trainer's death at SeaWorld Orlando and her connection with a CNN documentary about it called Blackfish, to which SeaWorld objects. Now this.
Political lady, I'll follow your line. Political lady, your movement's divine. One look at your platform and I'm feeling great. Your position on each issue keeps me wishing I could kiss you in every state.
Hillary Clinton was barely a year old in 1948 when a musical that celebrated a political lady flopped in Philadelphia. It took more than 50 years for That's the Ticket to reach New York, as one of the 70 often forgotten stage gems that have been recovered, reconstructed, and re-energized by Mel Miller's Musicals Tonight nonprofit theater. By that time, Hillary had been first lady for two terms, been defeated for president once, was serving as Secretary of State, and presumed to be planning a second campaign to reach her original goal, the presidency.
This week, Miller opens the 16th year of Musicals Tonight at the Off-Broadway Lion Theater on 42nd Street in New York with a delightfully old-fashioned feel. The 1959 show Little Mary Sunshine actually parodies the operetta era. America's Sweetheart by Richard Rodgers and Lawrence Hart hit Broadway in 1931. And For Goodness Sake by the Gershwin Brothers starred Fred Astaire and his sister Adele in 1922. To talk more about these shows and productions past for your ears only, Mel Miller joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Mark.
You graduated college with an engineering degree and worked for a big tech company. When and why did you decide to switch to reviving old musicals that weren't really being done by anyone else?
Well, it was certainly happenstance. I met a fellow named Wally. Don't remember his last name. We became chums. He was interesting. I was boring. He was involved in the internet. He was involved in theater. We were going to do an internet project, and sort of on the side, we were going to revive an old musical that I was in love with. Wally was bogus. He vanished with his girlfriend's money and credit card, and I thought, so much for show business. Then I thought, wait a minute, all a producer has to do is write checks. I can do that. I wrote the checks and did all the sweat equity associated with that particular show, which was called Let It Ride. That was in autumn of 1997. And I thought, you know, this is where my heart and my mind reside. Let's continue. And I basically abandoned my suits. My closet is now full of costumes.
Sometimes it takes a kind of forensic fanaticism to track down bits and pieces of an old show, scrape together scenes and songs, stitch them together, maybe add material the same writers did for a different show. What was your biggest headache along those lines?
Well, the headaches are the ones that I can't complete. The joys are the ones I do. Very briefly, there was a show called Walk with Music in 1939. It was the only book musical by Hoagie Carmichael and Johnny Mercer, and it starred Kitty Carlisle Hart. I worked and worked, and I cobbled as much as I could, and I couldn't make it happen. But the real success, non-headache, was Early to Bed. Stephen Susskind, who's written many books on theater, had one that had a gorgeous poster of the show Early to Bed. It was Fats Waller's only book musical from 1943. I found the librettist's daughter, who had a libretto, who had the lyric sheets and no music. Cut to the chase, or cut to black, as the case may be, I found, or was found by, Harold Stumpy Cromer. Harold was in the original production. Harold remembered all the songs, all the lyrics. He hummed them to us. We recorded them, and then we musicalized them, and we were able to do the show.
In some cases, you've not only revived the show, but the career of someone who was originally in it. Talk about the casting, the actor who starred in the musical So Long, 174th Street.
George S. Irving turned 91 on November 1st. He has done 6 shows for us. So the first show, he was barely 75. He won his Tony opposite Debbie Reynolds in Irene in 1962. We certainly were not instrumental at all in doing anything other than basking in George's glory. He did 6 shows for us, including several shows in which he originally starred. So Long, 174th Street, George was in that in the early 60s. That's the Ticket, George was in that in 1948. Me and My Girl, he was in it. The Happy Time, he was in it. Every show we've done with George has been a joy. The cast loves him. The audience loves him.
Well, we know about senior member George. What about the younger performers you cast? What brings them to shows and music so far from the contemporary entertainment all around them? Do you worry the supply will dry up?
What's interesting is that the young people, the people that we attract, still love theater in the traditional way. They realize via their pocketbooks that microphones and amplification are what's happening in a lot of venues. But when they're going through school, a lot of their training is very traditional. They revel in an opportunity to use that training. We had one performer who not too long ago was on stage on Broadway in Chorus Line. She belted out those songs. She was terrific.
The 16th year of Mel Miller's musical Tonight opens this week with Little Mary Sunshine, March 4 through 16, For Goodness Sake, March 18 through 30, and America's Sweetheart, April 1 through the 13th at the Lion Theater, 410 West 42nd Street, New York. Check it out at musicaltonight.org.
Your facts and your figures thrill me through and through. Political lady, you who I'm a voting for you.
Quote from the news, a whole new level of violation of our users' privacy that is completely unacceptable. That was a statement from Yahoo after documents newly leaked by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden indicated British intelligence, with NSA help, was secretly collecting webcam images from Yahoo users worldwide, many of them sexually explicit.
Next, Woody's Banjo Bell, for your ears only.
Back for your ears only. I'm Mark Garber.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. I was planning on making a major announcement tonight, but I decided tonight's your night. That was a tease by Vice President Joe Biden on the debut of NBC's Late Night with Seth Meyers. Fellow guest Amy Poehler was not shy about her plans. I'm going to run for president, she said. Now this.
Cole Porter on the banjo? It's not just music, it's a mission for Cynthia Sayer. After years playing in Woody Allen's legendary New Orleans jazz band gigs Monday nights at Manhattan's posh Carlyle Hotel, Sayer now performs across the country and around the world to make listeners love her four-string banjo, not the common five- or six-string variety, as much as she does.
She'll do it again this Friday, March 7th, at Joe's Pub in New York's Public Theater. But for your ears only, she's on the line now to talk about her latest show, her beloved banjo, and life and music generally. Cynthia Sayer, welcome to our show.
So happy to be here.
How and why did you pick up the banjo?
To be honest with you, banjo started because of drums. When I was 13, I saw a dance band at my school talent show, and I decided I wanted a drum set. I had a big fight with my parents, and I lobbied hard because I really wanted those drums. And my parents said, absolutely no. I had two brothers and a sister. We all played instruments, and that was like way too much racket in the house for them. And one day I came home from school, and there was this banjo on my bed, and I hardly knew what it was. I did have a vague association with bluegrass music, but I'd never seen a real banjo before. And I knew instantly it was a bribe, and I'd never get my drums. So I just thought, well, okay, I'll play this thing.
Well, historically, the banjo hasn't gotten a lot of respect, Cynthia. Why do you think that is?
It's just considered a fringe instrument, and there's a complication of, I believe, sort of socioeconomic reasons for that. Originally, it was an African instrument, and it was considered very lowbrow. It was part of Southern plantation black association, and then it became a female instrument. Women were simple and emotional, too, so that was okay. And it was a rebellious statement for women to play the banjo, this exotic thing, and eventually became a white male instrument. You know, it has this really amazing history. But, you know, if you think about it, you know, the banjo, folk music, and then in the four-string banjo world, sing-alongs and corny striped vests and all this kind of stuff, you know, it's got a kind of fringe association that it's had for its whole existence. And it's too bad, because it's a really important part of musical history, and it's a very vibrant part of so many genres of music, and that's one of my missions, because the four-string banjo is, like, so cool, and I want people to realize all that it has been and all that it is.
How rare are female banjo players these days, especially in jazz music, and did you feel any resistance from the boys in the bands?
Oh, well, I would say that for, like, almost my entire career, I was, like, always the only woman playing. But, you know, that's jazz. Early jazz in particular, for some reason, it was just never women. I was touring for, oh, I suppose about 10 years before I even played with another woman instrumentalist. There are always women singers, the occasional woman pianist, but instrumentalists in jazz, and particularly early jazz, they are few and far between. But I'm happy to say that in the past, very recently, like maybe 5 years or so, there's a whole new crop of these young women who are out there. There's some really great talent out there.
Well, what is it about the four-string banjo, rather than the five or six, that makes it different and more exciting to you?
Well, I like the swing, you know, I like jazz, and they're associated with a different feeling and a different kind of music. The five-string banjo, folk, bluegrass, country, that has a whole different world. And the world that I'm in is, you know, is a hot swing and early jazz style. Although, you know, I'm not from 1920, and I'm a person of today, and I believe in playing the instrument in a current, with a current sensibility. So I kind of take the early jazz sounds and make it my own. But, you know, it's just a different world.
You played extensively with filmmaker Woody Allen. How did you two get together?
Well, you know, Woody Allen is, as many people know, he loves early New Orleans music, and he plays the clarinet, and he has a jazz band in New York, and a lot of people, in a lot of the people who specialize in this music have come across him in, you know, the New York professional scene. And gosh, I met him and started working with him shortly after I came to New York, and eventually he changed his band, and I became a regular member of the band. And it's an experience. You know, when you live in New York City, you don't actually have a lot of opportunity to play this really old style of New Orleans music, which he likes, which is based on a sound of George Lewis Bunk Johnson, which might be getting a little too inside here for your show. But in any event, it's really fun music, and I had a blast in the band.
The New York Times calls Cynthia Sayer a rarity, a woman who plays the banjo with drive and virtuosity. You can catch her Friday, March 7th at Joe's Pub, 425 Lafayette Street in Manhattan, or on her latest CD, Joyride, available at cynthiasayer.com.
This has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only On Air is also online at iTunes, FeedBurner.com, and Stitcher.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studio Play It Productions with intern Sarah Skirmott. I'm Mark Garber.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts, supported by the Gatewave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities, the Best Memorial Trust, and award-winning ACAM Associates. Exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. Pledge your tax-deductible donation to davidearsonly@gmail.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago.
This week last year, we considered what might seem a medical contradiction, the spreading threat from non-communicable diseases, from our March 3rd, 2013 broadcast, hosted by Eddie Robinson and me.
There's an epidemic in this country of people being overweight, bordering on obesity. The number, percentage of the population that's obese is skyrocketing. In New York City alone, the number of deaths from smoking has declined so much, and the number of deaths from obesity has gone up so much. Those two are about to cross. We're going to have more deaths from obesity than from smoking. We've got to do something about it.
New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg's campaign against large sugary sodas has the food and beverage industry, some retailers, libertarians, and minority communities up in arms. But he's hardly alone. First Lady Michelle Obama, most notably, has been waging an Eat Right and Exercise campaign for the last 3 years, aimed at about a third of U.S. children who are overweight or obese. Some see evidence we've become a nanny state, but science agrees there's a larger societal problem to be dealt with. A new global burden of disease study shows that because the world's population is growing wealthier and medicine is getting better at treatment and prevention, the most serious health risks on the horizon now are not infectious diseases like tuberculosis and malaria, but the non-communicable variety, obesity, cancer, diabetes, and heart disease, brought on by lifestyle factors like tobacco use, air pollution, and bad eating habits.
In many parts of Latin America, the Middle East, and Asia, non-communicable diseases account for more than 70% of death and disability, and tobacco use kills more people per year worldwide than HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria combined. Obesity is the fifth largest cause of death worldwide, doubling over the last 30 years and affecting rich and poor countries alike. To talk about the changing panorama of health problems, the GBD study, its implications, and what can be done, for your ears only, we have Thomas Boyke, Council on Foreign Relations Senior Fellow for Global Health, Economics, and Development. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us more about this global burden study, how large and comprehensive it is, and who finances it.
This new study assessed 291 different diseases and injuries and their causes of those diseases in 187 countries over a 20-year period. It was conducted by Chris Murray and his colleagues at the University of Washington and funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, but ultimately involved 500 collaborators from over 300 institutions in 50 different countries in this world. It's just massive.
How does this latest study compare with previous research in terms of changing trends?
Well, it shows that many of the diseases you mentioned in your introduction, cancer, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, are now far surpassing the burden of infectious diseases, diseases like HIV/AIDS, malaria, and TB, in almost every region in the world. The dominant health risks now globally are behavioral, things like tobacco use, high blood pressure, air pollution. It's not really news that this transition is happening. We've known about this since at least 1996, but what has surprised people about this latest report is the speed with which it's happening. In 1990, 40% of the world's deaths resulted from non-communicable diseases. That's now over 80%. That's a dramatic shift in a relatively short period of time.
To what degree does a kind of moralistic thinking keep governments from devoting funds to fight lifestyles that can be now more deadly than bacteria and viruses?
To an enormous degree. There's been a big surge in global health funding over the last two decades, which is a good thing. There is roughly now $28 billion spent a year to help poor countries with their health problems. Only $187 million of that is spent on non-communicable diseases. To say that differently, we spend $300 each year for each year lost to disability to HIV, $200 for each year of disability lost to malaria, $100 for TB, but less than $1 for non-communicable diseases. And a lot of that is because they're growing fastest in middle-income countries like China and India. These diseases, as I mentioned, are behavioral. They're caused by tobacco use or high blood pressure. And there is cancer research that goes on in rich countries. What people are missing, though, is these diseases are actually thought of as diseases of the wealthy, but they're growing fastest amongst poor population in big urban slums in these poor countries. We are not talking about wealthy people. We are talking about the population of people that live under $2 a day, which is almost a billion.
Are there models to be found in the way government policy on cigarette packaging and public smoking in the U.S. helped fight lung cancer, beginning with the very vigorous public education campaign led by former U.S. Surgeon General C. Everett Koop, who died last week at 96?
And I should pause there to say the world lost a great hero in the former Surgeon General. He's really a pioneer on these issues. But certainly there is great evidence to show taxes, labeling, the types of technique used in tobacco work. They're very effective. Whether or not there's enough popular support for those tools on obesity remains to be seen. Tobacco is a product that really has no healthy use. It only harms people. Food is a bit different, so it's a challenge.
Let's talk about the role of the food and beverage industry, which keeps making its products more appealing, almost addictive, to make more profit. Some say the industry has the best expertise to fight global obesity, but others say it inevitably puts profits over healthful products and quietly undermines anti-obesity efforts. What's your view?
I think certainly the industry favors voluntary measures to address the health challenges that have arisen, the growing levels of obesity. There is not a lot of evidence for purely voluntary measures solving a problem like this. I think you need at least the credible threat of regulation to make progress. Whether you need to go to the lengths that have been gone to fight tobacco, which are entirely justified in that case to address the obesity challenge, will remain to be seen. But I do think you need a credible threat of regulation.
Thomas Boyke is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Caution, non-communicable disease, from our March 3, 2013 broadcast. Mayor Bloomberg lost his war against supersized sugary drinks, but the fight against obesity continued. Last week, notably, First Lady Michelle Obama spotlighted revised nutrition labels for packaged food. They featured bigger print for total calorie counts per serving and a larger serving for ice cream, one full cup, more in line with what people really eat.
Also last week, a report by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention showed that obesity in very young Americans, aged 2 through 5, had dropped by nearly half over the last 10 years, from 14% in 2003-04 to 8.1% in 2011-12. That gave public health experts hope that tots might bring better weight control along as they age.
Meanwhile, a new weapon in the war on smoking became both more popular and controversial: electronic cigarettes, which deliver nicotine but not tar and other toxic chemicals. The European Parliament last week agreed on tight new controls, but not on regulating e-cigs as medicines. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is expected soon to propose rules of its own. I'm Mark Garber.
And I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week.
Now, more Cynthia Sayer from the 2008 World Banjo Camp in Budapest.
I was just minding my business. Life was a beautiful song. I didn't have a care or a worry till you had to come along. Thank you. start something, you sure start something with them their eyes. You've got certain little cute way of flirting with them their eyes. Well, they make me feel so happy and they make me blue. Now, darling, I'm going to great feel.